says, after many days had gone by, the Jews conspired to kill him. So Paul gets saved. He changes from trying to kill Christians to preaching the gospel, and already they're trying to kill him. Skip down to verse 29. He talked and debated with the Grecian Jews, but they tried to kill him. So again, they attempt to try to take the life of Paul for preaching the gospel. Now skip over with me to Acts chapter 14. Verse 5. Notice, there was a plot afoot among the Gentiles and Jews together with their leaders to mistreat them and stone them. So again, they try to kill Paul. Skip down to verse 19. Then some Jews from Antioch came in Iconium, and won the crowd over, they stoned Paul, dragged him outside the city, thinking he was dead. Again, they try to kill Paul. Skip over to Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20 and verse 3. It says, where he stayed 3 months, because the Jews made a plot against him, just as he was about to set sail for Syria. So they again try to kill the Apostle Paul. Skip down to verse 19 of this chapter. Verse 19, I served the Lord with great humility and with tears, although I was severely tested by the plots of the Jews. Notice plural. The Jews again were trying to plot and kill the Apostle Paul. Now skip over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Down in verse 23. Paul, defending his ministry, says, are they servants of Christ? I'm out of my mind to talk like this. I am more. I've worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, and exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received the Jews 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. And you can just kind of read through this passage, and you'll see how, all the way through here, how close Paul came to being killed and dying. And yet he didn't. Now skip over with me to Acts chapter 22 and verse 30. And that's where we're going to begin tonight. But let me say this, we can trace the very same thing in the life of Christ. Matthew chapter 2, you remember that the Jews, when Jesus was first born, kill all the babies 2 years and younger because they tried to get at Christ and kill him. We read about again in Matthew chapter 12 where they try to kill Jesus once again. Mark chapter 11, they're looking to kill Christ again. You skip over to John chapter 5. They're looking to kill Christ again. One time they had him surrounded completely by a mob. And the Bible says he just kind of walked through their midst and left. There were many attempts on the life of Christ, many attempts on the life of Paul. But I want you to notice that in both of their lives, they did not die until their mission was finished. No matter how many times they tried to kill them, no matter how many times they tried to get at them, and even at times, the Apostle Paul was kind of next to death. But they did not die until their mission was finished. And that forms the backdrop for our passage tonight. And I want us to notice 3 things tonight. First of all, know with whom you are dealing. If you want to live this life and live a life that's pleasing to God and live a life that deals with situations in a correct manner, we have to know with whom we are dealing. For example, if you are talking to a scam artist, you know, whether it's on the phone or sometimes through the internet or people, you know, going door to door, we hear about them every year and all the time about people trying to scam you out of your money. if you know that person is a scam artist, and you know right up front, I don't want to hear anything you say, because I know your only desire is to take my money. But if you don't know, and the person's really convincing and does a real good job at cheating you, then it's possible that you could fall prey to them. And every year people do. Not knowing who you are dealing with can get you in a lot of trouble, and also knowing who you are dealing with can also help a situation. So I wanted you to see that in this passage tonight. Notice how not knowing can hurt. Verse 30. The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. So the commander, remember, this thing's kind of been going on in the last few chapters in the book of Acts. They had tried to kill Paul. The commander took him away to the fort next to the temple and was guarding him. He finally decides that he really doesn't know what's going on. And since the matter was probably Jewish and religious, he would take Paul before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin of the day was kind of the high council in Israel. In it, there were Pharisees and Sadducees and other the Jewish religious leaders. And it would kind of be like today, the Supreme Court in America. He decides, I'm going to bring them before this gathering of the leaders of the Jews and try to figure out what's going on here. And notice what happens, chapter 23 and verse 1. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good consciousness to this day." At this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck." Those who were standing near Paul said, "You dare to insult God's high priest?" Paul replied, "Brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'Do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'" So he's brought before the Sanhedrin, the high court. Paul immediately stands up and announces his innocence. Basically says, "Look, I've been doing everything I believe God wants me to do, and I believe I've been doing it rightly." Well, as you've seen already with some of the passages we've looked at, just like in the life of Christ, the Sanhedrin wanted Paul dead. Jews wanted him dead. So they didn't want to hear him declaring his innocence. So immediately Ananias calls on those all around Paul to strike him, basically to slap him in the face. Kind of say, "We don't believe you, and we really believe that you are wrong in saying what you're saying." Well, Ananias was an interesting character. He was high priest at the time. In fact, he was high priest from 48 AD to 59 AD. And he was a character. He was known for his greed and dishonesty. In fact, he was known for his brutality in the first century. So it kind of fits with history. Him wanting to strike Paul in the face fits within his personality. When the Jews revolted against Rome in 66 AD, they really did not like Ananias. He was known to sympathize with the Romans. So when they rebelled against Rome in 66 AD and began kind of a little four-year skirmish, a small war with the Romans, which ultimately ended in the Romans coming to Jerusalem, destroying the temple, and killing over 1 million Jews, the Jews tracked Ananias down. And they finally found him hiding in an aqueduct in Herod's palace, and they killed him. So this guy was not a well-loved character in Jerusalem, in Israel, but yet what was going on here kind of fit within his personality, fit with the Jewish hatred of the beginnings of Christianity. So he orders that he strikes Paul in the face, gives him a slap on the face, and I want you to notice that Paul immediately calls him a whitewashed wall. This was not within the character of the Apostle Paul. I can imagine by this time, Paul is tired. He's probably hungry. He's been attacked The Romans have already had to rescue him out of the area of Herod's temple. And he kind of strikes back at the person giving this command. To call some a whitewashed wall was basically calling them a hypocrite. A whitewashed wall was taking plaster or lime and kind of whitewashing the wall to cover up the impurities or the problems in a wall, and you're basically just putting a cover over problems. If you have ever done remodeling in a home, often when you begin to rip a home apart to remodel that home, you find an awful lot of things that have been covered up. So that's the idea here, that he was really covering up his heart, and he was nothing more than a hypocrite. And that was basically true of the religious leaders of Jesus' day. That's what Jesus called them. In fact, Jesus even called them snakes when he had confrontations with the Pharisees before his crucifixion. But this is out of character for Paul. And I want you to notice even down in verse 5, he's basically apologizing, saying, I didn't know he was the high priest. He says, brothers, I didn't realize that he was the high priest, for it is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. It says that in Exodus chapter 22 and verse 28, and Paul's basically saying, I'm wrong, I'm sorry. I don't think it changes the fact that the high priest at the time really was a hypocrite, but the way he lashed out, and he should have still shown some respect for the office that he held, even though the man probably was not respectable. And Paul says, look, I'm sorry. I didn't realize he was the high priest. It's possible when the commander called everybody together, called the Sanhedrin together, that the high priest didn't go and put his garments on that made him look like the high priest. So he just looked like one of the guys in the crowd, not realizing who he was, kind of shouted back pretty quickly and pretty strongly, calling him a hypocrite. And Paul didn't realize he was the high priest. And I believe basically here apologizes for that. And that's why the high priest has him slapped. You know, when you don't know who you're dealing with, sometimes that can get you into trouble. It kind of reminds me of the internet. You know, you go on the internet and people are sometimes willing to say all kinds of things because they think people don't know who they are. Or sometimes they don't know who they're talking to, so they're willing to say all kinds of things that you can type into a computer. And sometimes people are that way over the phone, too. You know, people who can tend to be really meek, you get them on the internet, you get them on the phone, all of a sudden they're out of their personality, and they're being really strong when, if they're staying face-to-face, they wouldn't be that way. So Paul basically says, look, I didn't realize he was the high priest. If I did, I wouldn't have said what I said. You know, the same thing happened to Jesus, and Jesus protests his innocence, and kind of was in the same kind of situation. He didn't know who he was talking to. It's important that we know who we're talking to. We know who we're dealing with. You know, again, if you don't know who you're talking to, sometimes you get scammed. If you don't know, understand the personality of the person you're talking to, sometimes you can take them out of context with their personality. And that's one of the reasons sometimes I hate email. You know, because people can get emailing back and forth, and because you don't see their face or you don't hear their voice, you can take what they're saying or what they're writing totally out of context with the way they meant it. And I think a lot of trouble can happen through emails that may not have happened if we were standing face to face. Same thing is true with preaching. We've been talking in the preaching class with the guys that we have in it. You need to know your audience. You need to know who you're talking to so that you can apply a message properly to the people who are listening. It is important that we know with whom we are dealing with. When we don't, we can find ourselves in situations like Paul finds himself in. But if we know who we're dealing with, it can also help a situation. So notice the opposite here. Knowing can help. Notice down in verse 6. Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. I think at this point, Paul realizes he's not going to get a fair trial. So he decides what he's going to do is the old adage, divide and conquer. So he has two groups within the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And he decides he's going to take a position and let people know where he stands. And ultimately, that would divide those who are hearing this case, cause them to attack one another, and kind of take their eyes off Paul. So it's important here that we understand a little of the background of the Sanhedrin. Altogether, there were 71 men who made up the Sanhedrin. The high priest would be the leader of the Sanhedrin. That's why Ananias is the one doing the talking here. But in the Sanhedrin, as I said, there would be Pharisees, there would be Sadducees. So Paul kind of comes down and says, look, I'm a Pharisee. I'm the son of a Pharisee. He's kind of putting himself under the Pharisees here, knowing that the Sadducees are immediately going to kind of take a stance against that. Because in the first century, the Pharisees and Sadducees tended not to get along together. They had disagreements. They didn't agree on doctrine. In fact, you see it here in our passage. Notice verse 7. When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Sadducees say there is no resurrection, and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. What was the difference between the Sadducees and Pharisees? And what is Luke kind of mentioning here? If I could put it kind of in the simplest terms possible. The Sadducees did not believe at all in the supernatural. They were kind of the humanists of the day. They just believed in what you could see and what you could touch and what you could feel. The Pharisees, on the other hand, they believed in an afterlife. They believed in angels. They believed in the power of God, even though they didn't always live it out in their life. So Paul stands up and says, look, I'm on trial because I believe in the supernatural. I believe in the resurrection of the dead. I believe that there's life after this life. In saying that, that would put the Pharisees and the Sadducees and their perspective kind of off Paul and at one another. Since Paul knew he wasn't going to get a fair trial anyway, the best thing to do is to get out of this trial. So by knowing the difference between the two, he kind of says where he stands, and it creates a conflict between both of them. And he gets the attention off him and on each other. And he knows by doing that, he can possibly get out of this situation. So notice a dispute breaks out. They begin arguing with each other, and then down in verse 9, this dispute becomes pretty strong. There was a great uproar. And some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously. We find nothing wrong with this man. They said, what if the spirit or an angel has spoken to him? The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. So it's getting so bad there that the commander again has to rescue Paul. He thinks they're literally going to rip him apart because of this situation. Now, it's kind of like, let's say we had a church meeting. And I stood up and said, you know what? If we really want to serve God to our fullest potential as a church, this green carpet is really ugly. And we need to get a bright pink carpet. And this side of the room says, well, you know, we think that's great. Pastor, we're with you. We think pink is a perfect color. And this side of all of you who are sitting here tonight said, are you nuts? You're going to bring in pink carpet? When people walk in with dirty shoes, we're going to get mud all over the carpet. Who's going to clean the carpet? You got to be crazy to think a pink carpet is going to work in a church setting. You know, it's going to clash with the color of the chairs and the color of the curtains, and it's just going to look ugly. And we start, you know, kind of going over it, and, you know, we just break out in the big fight, and this side's pulling this way, and that side's pulling that way. Of course, that's kind of a simplistic thing of what's happening here with the Apostle Paul. But it's basically what's happening. They're beginning to fight amongst one another. Paul's kind of there in the midst of it. And the commander, as we saw last Sunday night, he thinks Paul's going to be killed. I got to get him out of the situation. I got to get away from this, or they're going to kill him again.
understand situations, can help us understand what's going on, can help us understand how to respond. Sometimes when we get in situations, we really don't think about the other person, we think about ourselves. And we sometimes say to ourselves things like, you know, if that were me, I wouldn't have acted that way. Therefore, they shouldn't have acted that way. If that were me, I wouldn't have thought that way. Therefore, they shouldn't have thought that way. But we need to realize that when we're dealing with people, we need to understand where they're coming from, what's going on in their life, what they're thinking, how they're viewing the situation. And we sometimes don't think about that in dealing with people. And if we could do that and understand the people that we're dealing with, we would find ourselves getting out of a lot of hot water that sometimes we walk right into because we don't understand that it is important to know whom we're dealing with. Well, Paul's in this situation. He's getting really feisty. Commander's scared that he's going to get torn apart. So the commander steps in once again, and he kind of pulls Paul out of this situation. Think about where you might be at in your life if you were the Apostle Paul. Your desire is to do what God wants you to do. Your desire is to, at this point, remember he had brought an offering to Jerusalem, and after he had brought that offering to Jerusalem, it was in Paul's mind that he was going to head to Rome. He wanted to go where the gospel had not been heard. He ultimately, most scholars believe, wanted to end up in Spain. But he wanted to get to Rome. That was kind of the ultimate objection or idea of Paul, goal of Paul at this point. So here you are, people have tried to kill you several times in your life. You're now in this situation again. Maybe you're beginning to think, am I ever going to get out of this? Is this going to be the end of my life? Is this it? You're now sitting in a jail, probably getting discouraged, probably wondering where God is, probably wondering how you got yourself into this situation. Now, why don't you notice what happens here in verse 11? It's kind of the center point of this whole passage.
So notice, secondly, that we need to rely on God's word in tough times. Notice verse 11. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." Could you imagine in the midst of this, God appears to him. This is the fourth time that God has appeared to him that we're told about in the book of Acts. And God's word is pretty simple. Take courage. Take courage. And this word to Paul is stated in the phrase or the terminology of a command. It's not a kind of just kind of coming to Paul and rubbing him on the shoulder and say, you know, Paul, I want you to be encouraged. He's coming to Paul and he's saying, take courage. Get your spirits up. Take courage. It is an imperative. It is a command. He's saying, be of good cheer. He's saying, don't be afraid. He's saying, Paul, in the midst of this turmoil, in the midst of these problems, what I want you to do is be courageous. I think of John chapter 16 and verse 33. Jesus speaking to the disciples in the upper room, and he said, "I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world." You know, we don't, besides this church, we don't always hear that preached. We kind of hear sermons that say, you know what, God's going to take all your problems away. Jesus said you're going to have trouble. But I want you to do is take courage. I think of Matthew chapter 14, where you remember that Jesus had sent the disciples out, and they're rowing in the storm. Jesus back on shore praying, and then after a while, he decides he's going to walk on the water out to the disciples. They see Jesus coming, and they get scared to death, and they say, "It's a ghost." And Jesus' words, again, are the same. Again, are a command. Take courage. Kind of like in John 16 where it says, take heart. And we see this at various points in Scripture where the command is basically the same. Take courage, take courage, take courage, take heart. Don't let this world beat you up so that you want to give up and quit and just want to kind of throw the whole thing in. take courage. Don't quit. Don't give up. I think it's Psalm 46, verse 1 and 2, where it says that, psalmist says, look, even if the whole world were to cave in, I would still put my hope in God and still would not give up. Psalm 41:10 says, you know, in the midst of all the problems that we need to keep going. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 8 through 10, Paul says, look, we were at the point of giving up. But it all happened that we might rely on God, and we kept going. And probably my favorite psalm of all the psalms, Psalm 121, talks about God watching over us and God taking care of us and how we need to keep our courage. I think all too often as Christians, we let every little thing get in our life and we're just so easy to give up and quit. You know, it's kind of like we get a splinter in our finger, and we just want to go and, you know, cry to a doctor and say, fix it. And we're kind of in this world because everything's so quick to fix things. We want everything now. We want everything today. And we want to escape all the storms of life. And when we get in those storms, we just want to quit. I want you to know that what God is saying here to Paul, it's not a pat on the back. It's not a hope you feel better. It's not, well, you'll laugh about it later. It's not, you know, just kind of make it through. He's commanding him, take courage. In the midst of this, in the midst of all that's going on, take courage. And he gives Paul a reason for that courage. Notice again in verse 11. He says, as you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify about me in Rome. If I can put that in my own words, here's what God is saying to Paul. Your time is not up. Your time is not up. This thing will not end in your death. You still will do the very same thing you're doing here, testifying about me, but you're going to do it in Rome. God's hand was upon Paul. And no one would take the life of Paul until Paul had finished his task. Back in Acts chapter 9, verse 15, God had said to Paul, Christ had said to Paul that, you know, you're going to go through all kinds of problems and all kinds of difficulties, but you're going to preach before me, before kings and before leaders. And most people believe that Paul, when he got to Rome, actually did speak before the emperor. Fulfilled what God had said about his life when he had first gotten saved. Fortunately, I see so many Christians living in fear. So many Christians who are sometimes afraid to walk out of their house, sometimes afraid to get in the car, kind of always looking over the shoulder and just living this life, always afraid what people might do to them. Kind of scared of their own shadow. And I want you to see in this passage a life-freeing truth that can free you from all that fear. And it's simply this. No one can harm you unless God allows that to happen. And if God allows that to happen, then there's nothing you could do about it anyway. You know that? We talked about it a little bit about this morning, but no one can harm you unless God allows it. Now, either we believe that God is sovereign, either we believe that God is in control, either we believe that God's protecting hand is there, or we're going to live our lives in fear. And I want you to know, for a Christian to live their life in fear is so unbecoming. It's so out of character of what the Christian life is to be about. It's so far-fetched from the way we ought to live our lives. And I see so many Christians running around. They're scared about everything. They're afraid about, you know, driving a car. They're afraid about going out at night. They're afraid about doing this, afraid about doing that. We have a sovereign God who's telling Paul in the midst of a very difficult situation where they're trying to kill Paul, take courage. And I have yet, at least in our lives, at least where we live right now, to see a whole bunch of people chasing after life to kill you. And now maybe there was a time or two in your life where maybe you got yourself in situations and that clearly could have happened. But nothing like the Apostle Paul, nothing like where it's almost a daily event where they want to take his life for being a Christian. Yet God said to him, take courage. Augustine said something really interesting that kind of fits this situation. He said, trust the past to the mercy of God, the present to his love, and the future to his providence. In other words, we're in the hand of God, and we ought to trust God's hand. And ultimately, if something does happen to you, it's because God has allowed that in. And ultimately, if your life is taken, it's because God is finished with what you were to do in this life. And you're not going to die a second before that, and you're not going to die a day after that or a second after that. That doesn't mean that we can't do things in our own life, maybe to shorten our life, but God is sovereign, and God's hand is upon you, and we need to take courage in every single situation. And I know there's times in our life where it just seems like this world is beating us up so much, or it just seems like life is, you know, hitting us full force, that we just feel like, you know, we can't go on. But God's command is to take courage and go on and complete the task that God has given you to do. So with that, I want us to notice the third thing here in this passage. That being true, don't fret about the plots of men. Don't fret about the plots of men. Don't worry about what men might do to you. Notice the conspiracy to kill Paul in verse 12. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy. Paul has now been taken back to the palace. He's now under Roman guard. But some Jews gather together the very next morning and they form a conspiracy. Notice, and they bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petitioned the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about this case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here. Very simple plot. They want the Jewish leaders, many of them religious leaders, to lie. And say they want Paul brought before them on the pretext of, you know, wanting to know more and wanting to basically convene the court again. These men say, we'll kill Paul on the way. Notice there's 40 of them, so their thinking is, some of us are going to die trying to kill Paul, but we're willing to die for this cause. They had took an oath that they wouldn't eat or drink, they would fast until Paul was dead. I think that shows the seriousness and how strong their desire was to kill Paul. That's the plan. The conspiracy is to get Paul out of the way. The desire is to have Paul dead. But again, remember, God had told Paul that he needed to take courage. God had told Paul that he would still witness in Rome. So notice what happens, verse 16. But when the sons of Paul's sister, his nephew, heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Now, on the surface, just looking at this, we say, well, you know, this is just a natural occurrence. The nephew just happens to overhear the plot. But I want you to know what's really going on here is the sovereign hand of God behind the scenes, protecting and watching over the life of Paul to make sure that he did not die until he had finished the mission that God had given him to do. I wonder how many times in our lives, the guardian angels, God's workers, were watching over our life. I wonder how many times maybe when we missed that car accident or missed that situation or missed, you know, maybe something that could have happened in our life and we didn't know, and maybe easily we could have been dead, but God's sovereign hand was in there and he protected us from those kinds of situations. We probably will never know those situations until we stand before God. And then God's going to review our life, and we're going to look back over our life, and sometime we're going to see some of the situations and say, oh, that's how I got out of that. Other times we're going to say, wow, I didn't know that almost happened. The nephew hears of the plot. And notice verse 17. Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." So he took him to the commander. Centurion said, "Paul, the prisoner, sent for me and asked me to bring you this young man to you because he has something to tell you." Commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside, and asked, "What is it you want to tell me?" He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for you to consent to their request." The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, "Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me." The commander, again, learns of the information, humanly trying to protect the Apostle Paul. The reality is that God's hand is behind what's going on. The commander then, notice verse 23, calls for two centurions. Remember, centurions each are over 100 men. He called two of the centurions and ordered them, "Get ready for it. Get a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 o'clock or at 9 tonight. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix." Now, this is interesting. We have 200 soldiers, 200 horsemen, and 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. So if you add that all together, we have 470 men altogether. Now again, looking at historical records, we know that this commander was over about 1,000 soldiers. They were in that fort that was right next to the temple. He had command of 1,000 men. So he's actually taking half of his command to protect the Apostle Paul. This is almost tantamount to what would be royal treatment, to what you would do for a king. And he's doing this for the Apostle Paul. He's going to take him to the Governor Felix out of Jerusalem, where he believes Paul can get a fair trial. So notice he writes a letter, verse 25. He wrote a letter as follows: "Claudius Lysias," that's the commander's name, "to his excellent Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and they were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him. For I had learned that he was a Roman citizen." Now, if you remember from last night, you will know that this is a lie. He didn't learn that Paul was a Roman citizen to much later than that, but he makes it sound good for himself. And he kind of tells a lie here. Verse 28. "I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. Found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered that his accusers to present to you their case against him." So the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. Antipatris was roughly 35 miles from Jerusalem. From Jerusalem to Antipatris, this 35 miles was an area where it was rough terrain and easy for people to be hiding and possibly find this guard going and attack the guard. That's why the commander sends so many men with the Apostle Paul. Once you get past this point, there's about another 27 miles to Caesarea. But it wasn't as mountainous. It was a little bit easier for the guard to guard the Apostle Paul, a little bit safer for him to do that. So I want you to notice in verse 32, the cavalry goes back. The next day they let the cavalry goes down, the rest of the men go back. The next day they let the cavalry go with him while they return to the barracks. So 270 men go back to the barracks, 200 more men continue to guard Paul, all the way, notice, to Caesarea. When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor, handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear your case when your accusers get here. Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. When we look at this passage, it's clear, another clear indication that they want to kill the Apostle Paul, another clear circumstance where they wanted Paul dead. But as I said, I believe the key verse is verse 11 of chapter 23. That basically told Paul, in the midst of his problems, in the midst of his difficulties, what he needed to do more than anything else is be courageous. Because there's a basic principle and a basic truth. And it's the very same thing that's true for your life and mine. No harm is ever going to come to you unless God allows it. And no one, no matter how evil, no matter how wicked they are, is going to come in your life and kill you before God is finished with the mission that he's given you to do. Now, that can only happen when we are in the center of God's will. That can only happen as we seek to love God and serve God. And that's really what Romans 8:28 is all about. That God is at work in your life, bringing all the circumstances of life together for your good and ultimately for his glory. You know, there's very important three verses that really connect to this passage. And Paul wrote them at the very end of his life. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8, he writes to Timothy and he says, look, I have finished the race, I have fought the fight, and I have kept the faith. Notice that little phrase, I have finished the race. What he was saying to Timothy was, this. I have completed the task that God has given me. If we can grab hold of that truth, if we can understand that reality, if we can understand what God or what Satan said about Job in Job chapter 1, that God puts a hedge around those that he loved, and there's no way anyone can get through that hedge unless God allows it. And again, if God allows it, there's a purpose, there's a reason. And there's nothing we can do about it anyway because God has allowed it. If you can really grab hold of that truth will free your life from so much fear. From so much fear that can be true of people in our world. From so much fear that can be true of all the things you hear everybody talking about, global warming and, you know, world wars and terrorism and, you know, the whole thing with Social Security and the health care and all those things. We can simply put our trust in God and follow the command, the very command he gave Paul. Take courage. In every situation we